welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We begin Main Street today as the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library prepares to open this Saturday in Medora. In a philosophical currents discussion, we ask the question, what are museums really for? If museums shape public memory, who decides what is worth remembering? And what do admission fees say about who gets to belong inside that story? July 4th, the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library opens in Medora, perched above the Badlands landscape that Roosevelt himself said shaped his life. The library says it's not a traditional presidential library, but a story-driven experience about leadership, citizenship, conservation, and Theodore Roosevelt's lasting relevance. And that makes it a perfect opening for a bigger question. When a museum opens its doors, what exactly is it inviting the public into? History, memory, civic identity, or a carefully curated argument about all three? There's also the practical and moral question right at the door. The library plans timed entry admission with adult tickets priced at $26 and youth tickets at $16, along with discounts for some groups. It's not unusual in museums around the world, but museums ethics standards also describe museums as public serving, accessible institutions that hold collections and knowledge in trust for the public. So if a cultural memory is a public good, when is it fair to charge for entry? And what does the price tag, what happens when it becomes a barrier? Well, to think all of this through about why we have museums, we're pleased to be joined by my good friend, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. This segment is called Philosophical Currents, and Jack is with the University of North Dakota. He's a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy there. He's also the director of the Institute for Philosophy in Public Life and the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. Its broadcast airs on the second Sunday right here on Prairie Public. Jack, welcome to Philosophical Currents.
I am happy to be here as always. Summer is such a nice time and a really good moment to reflect on some of the deeper questions that are invisible. The museum thing is such a fascinating topic because it's one of those instances where most people don't give it much thought at all. And then the second you start pulling that thread, there is so much complexity and so much ethical perspective and so many different positions that it becomes really a microcosm of almost all of our political arguments.
Oh boy, does it ever. When I started thinking about this, I wondered, are we going to have enough to talk about? And we certainly do here.
That has never been our problem.
No, it sure hasn't. But let's start at the very top. Let's not get into prices or politics, but what's the best argument, Jack, for museums in the first place? What public good do they provide that a book or a documentary or a website couldn't also do?
Many years ago, I heard an interview with the ambassador from Pakistan. And he said this very interesting thing that has stayed with me for probably 20 years, which is America has a unique experience with history and that it's the only place where water under the bridge means it's not relevant anymore. There's something very specific about the American experience that we don't like to look backwards, that sometimes it makes us uncomfortable, but often it traps us into forward-moving paths that we as Americans don't like to be controlled in that way. So many of other cultures and identifiable ethnic groups and religions are defined by their history and are fighting battles that took place not 150 years ago, but 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago, and people still have these tremendous hatreds and animosities and suspicions from something that happened 27 generations ago. America has some of that baggage, but not nearly enough. So, in the context of America itself, the question of what is the purpose of a museum if history is something to be overcome or something to be passed over, rather than in a place where history is codified and glorified and defining our social roles? So automatically, any museum has to ask itself, what role does it play in the culture? This is a history museum. It plays a certain role, which might be different than an art museum. But there is another problem, and that is the following. Everything in a museum is decontextualized. John Dewey, the American philosopher, called this museumification. He said that if you take something and put a frame around it, you detach it from the rest of the world. And it becomes an aesthetic object, an object to look at, but it doesn't tell you a story. Every Teddy Roosevelt artifact is itself an art object unless we know the story behind it. Why is this hat important? Why is this gun important? Why is this horse important? And the museum's job is either to let us have that free-form experience or to push us to understand it in a certain way. And then the question becomes, what way? And as you alluded to, who decides what way? So the fundamental core problem of all museums is, do we look at something detached from its history, or do we look at something contextualized in the process that created it and the intentions that led us to this moment?
I thought, Jack, when the Obama Presidential Library opened a week or two ago, President Obama essentially said this: I didn't want to build a place of nostalgia. I wanted to build a place of looking forward. Well, translated, agenda to me, that he wanted to build a place that had his vision, perhaps his family's vision, and perhaps others' visions of what an America will look like in the future. But it led to me this question then: those decisions, it seems to me, are thought about by those people that you just talked about, who are in charge of presenting to us what it is that we are seeing, bringing it into our lives as we move forward.
It's such an interesting example because it's almost impossible to distinguish between, as I was sort of getting at before, the history and what you're calling the agenda. Because on the one hand,
and maybe that word isn't right. Maybe that word has too negative of a context, but that's what it felt like to me.
I don't think it's a negative context, and I don't think that agenda is a bad word. I think we all have agendas, and I think that there's some agendas that are more public and we're more honest about than others. But that's, you know, there's you go out for a beer with your friends. Sometimes your agenda is to avoid housework. Sometimes your agenda is to meet someone new and exciting. Sometimes your agenda is to drink that beer your husband won't let you drink, right? I mean, there's 1,000 agendas. But President Obama's vision is always looking forward because that's how he wants to describe his past. He wants to say, I have always been the kind of person who has looked forward. And so detaching that yes, we can, hopeful message from the rhetoric of yes, we can and hopeful history is virtually impossible. So the question that you pose is also a central one, because I would frame it as the following. When there is a museum named after a certain person, the Theodore Roosevelt Museum, the President Obama Library, is it a monument for how the world looks at that person? Or is it a monument to try to communicate how that person looks at the world, right? Are we saying, when we go to the Theodore Roosevelt Museum, are we saying, this is how the world felt about Roosevelt, and this is the way that people reacted to his actions? Or are we saying, This is a glimpse into the mind of someone who saw the world from a particular way, and we're going to help you understand that mind as opposed to the reactions to that mind. So from the very beginning, this question of perspective forces us to ask, what does it mean to center the topic? Does it mean we are going to create a story around it? Or does it mean we are going to be subservient to the voice that we are trying to represent? And of course, both of those perspectives have many complex consequences that have to be thought through. Is the President Obama Library a place where we get to see how and why President Obama did things from his own perspective? Or is the President Obama Library a monument for how the world received him? And then, of course, the question is negatively or positively.
Enjoying my conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, we visit monthly in a segment we call Philosophical Currents. Today, we're talking about museums. Why do we have them? Who gets to decide what's in them? And maybe what should we think about when we're inside a museum? Jack, I want to push this a little farther. What's the difference between a curator and a historian?
Oh, that's a really good question. And I'll add a third term just to help both complicate and clarify. There's a term called historiography, and historians will be very insistent about this distinction. History is this thing that happened. The United States gained independence in 1776. The bomb was dropped on Hiroshima in 1945, right? This thing that happened. But then there's the way that we tell the story of the thing, the biography of the thing. And that's historiography. Historiography is the method of doing and communicating history. So there is, in philosophy, we'd say an epistemological problem, a problem of knowledge. There's the problem of knowledge of history, which is how do we really know what happened if we weren't there? And if we were there, how do we get past our limited perspective? How do we discover what the truth is, whatever that means? What kind of things do we regard as important? So, for example, one of the great debates about the bombing of Hiroshima is that the leadership, the American leadership, felt at the time that much more damage, more people would die in a ground invasion, especially more soldiers would die in a ground invasion, than would die in the bombing of the city. And so as a historian, we have to ask, is it more important to consider a soldier's perspective or a non-combatant citizen's perspective, but also, is it even coherent to ask about an individual soldier's life because a soldier is giving themselves up to the collective, whereas a citizen at Hiroshima did not give themselves up to the collective, and so their individuality is more important, right? So history is trying to ask what's important and what actually happened. Historiography is the process of telling that story, of making connections, and that's always going to be a narrative. That's always going to be a tale with a beginning, a middle, and an end, because that's how human beings think. We are storytelling creatures. We find meaning and purpose and value in the way that the events of our lives connect to one another. And so, a museum, if it is solely interested in history, it's going to give us facts of the matter. And there will be dispute as to whether those facts are accurate or not, or defensible, and there'll be scholarly debates. Or it's going to give us the story that it wants us to learn. And the American Holocaust Museum is a really, really useful example. It's been years since I've gone, but it's one of the great museum experiences. You walk in and they give you a little booklet of the name of a Holocaust victim and a little biographical paragraph. And it then tells the story of the Holocaust chronologically and encourages you at the whole time to ask about this particular specific person. What happened to this person? How would this person have experienced this thing? Because it wants you to have a personal relationship and wants you to see the individual humanity in the face of the overwhelming horror that we can only understand statistically. If you've seen Schindler's List, you'll remember that Spielberg took one character, this girl, and put her in a red coat, and you just, everything else is in black and white and she's in a red coat. It's that same sort of thing. So a narrative is supposed to tell us a story that we identify with in a certain way. That's what history is. A curator is going to take the details of that history and ask, what are the most interesting parts of it for my purposes? And how am I intentionally going to arrange the selective parts of the history to highlight what I think is important and what I don't think is important? A curator's job, by definition, is to say, look at this thing instead of looking at that thing. Pay attention to this hat, to use the early examples, as opposed to this gun. And then to put it in a context that you understand on some level why we're paying attention to the hat as opposed to the gun. A historian is trying to excavate a past and have it make sense. A curator is trying to take a certain aspect of that past, highlight it over all the other things, and then present it in whatever light they specifically want to present it to the public. So a historian may be focused to scholars or general audiences. A curator in most instances is going to recognize that the people who walk into the museum don't have expertise, they're not specialists, they're not aware of the academic debates that provide the context for the curation, and how are they going to communicate all of this information in a way that is a story that is identifiable to people whose only encounter with the subject is going to be in that museum.
And of course, there's expense involved with that. The museum forever hopefully wants to keep its doors open, its lights on, its curators working. So then the question becomes, when is it right and okay to charge for admission like the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library will do? I talked about that in my open. Is that the fairest principle, to have a barrier for some of a cost of admission?
This is both a really difficult and a really simple issue at the same time, right? In the sense that on some level, especially in a democracy where we believe that all people are equal, at least politically, and that all people should have the same access to information and story and our past and our interpretations, there is a very strong case for museums to be free, especially when they are tax funded, right? Because we have already paid for this. In a society in which inequality is increasing at a very fast rate, you don't really think about it in these terms, but museums are a tool to either mitigate or intensify that inequality. We become equal by having similar stories. We become equal by having access to the same knowledge. And if only the wealthy kids in the wealthy school districts can go to the museum because their schools can afford the entrance fees, or if only upper middle class people can bring their kids to the museum, then that means in 5 years down the road, in 10 years down the road, that wealthy school district or those upper middle class kids already have an advantage and they succeed more. Now, it's also complex because there are priorities that we have to make choices about. Do you fund cancer? Do you fund the museum? If we're talking about public institutions, there is a scarcity of funds. However, and this is really going to be hopefully the only thing that people that I'll say that will be people might have a partisan reaction to. If we just look at the last week or two and the debate about the reflecting pool in Washington, D.C., I think the last number that I saw was that we have so far spent $16 million in order to renovate, then repair, and now protect the reflecting pool. If the government can find $16 million, you know, from nowhere for this thing, why can't it find $5 million for the Teddy Roosevelt Museum? Do we really have a scarcity of funds, or do we only fund the things that are the priority of the people who are making those decisions? So, in principle, as a philosopher, as a museum lover, as an art lover, I believe that all those things should be free and accessible to all people at all times. As a realist, I understand that sometimes you have to make financial decisions, but I'll pick on a private museum, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. If the Sackler family, pharmaceutical family, is making a $100 million donation to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, to spend it on a new wing of the museum as opposed to free admissions for everyone who walks through those doors feels like the wrong priorities and a violation of the public responsibility of public history and public art.
Jack, you bring up an interesting point that's provocative to me. And people say that art museums and cultural institutions sometimes only belong to the wealthy or the highly educated. And I'm curious from your perspective, is that a lazy stereotype that we've just kind of put out there? Is that necessarily really the case?
It really depends on what you mean by belongs to. Because of course, when you are poor and you have to work two jobs to feed your family, and when you live in a place that's very far away from these resources, or you are in a place maybe where it's too dangerous to go to these places, then you don't have access to those things. And so by definition, to go to a museum is to have a kind of leisure time and a kind of freedom and a kind of accessibility that poor people just don't have. And it doesn't have to be, right, the stereotypical urban poor who are, you know, struggling through certain kinds of circumstances. It can also be the person who is spending all of their time on the harvest and holding their farm or their ranch together with their bare hands because the loan payments are too high, and a drive to the museum in their car that they're not 100% confident would make long drives anyway is an 8-hour drive away, right? So just the mere fact of being poor takes away people's options. However, art, history are owned by the human race. Yes, the Louvre in Paris owns technically the Mona Lisa, but the Mona Lisa is what it is because of the history of all of the things that led to it and because of the meaning that we imposed on it. So years ago, I had Professor Adam Kitsis from UND on Why Radio, and we asked the question, why is Shakespeare still relevant? And I asked him if Shakespeare was incredibly important, and his answer was, yes, Shakespeare is incredibly important, but only because we continue to make Shakespeare incredibly important. Our culture constantly quotes and builds off of Shakespeare the way that our culture constantly builds and quotes the Mona Lisa. You can't say something like that is owned by an individual person. You can't say something like that is the private intellectual property of an individual person. And there is a conversation to be had as to whether or not we have a moral obligation to present these great works of art or what have you to the general public.
And that's my next question, Jack. We're going to take a pause for just a moment as we break for this news. I'm enjoying my conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. More after this. Welcome back to Main Street and Philosophical Currents. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and as the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library prepares to open in Medora, we're using the moment to explore a larger question: what role do museums play in shaping how we understand history, identity, and public life? Joining me is Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein of the University of North Dakota, as we consider whether museums are simply places to preserve the past or institutions that help communities decide what stories matter most. Jack, you were just getting to my next question before I interrupted you, so I'm sorry for that interruption. But let's say that the Mona Lisa was stored in someone's attic or in his dining room and it was never shared. Do owners of memorabilia of significant art have a moral obligation to share with us?
The underlying really abstract debate beneath this is whether or not there really is something called intellectual property. And if so, what is the nature of that property? So, right, does someone own the cure for cancer that they discover? Let's look at this in two ways. Let's look at this in terms of, let's say, highway tolls and then math. There's a certain argument to be made that if you're going to use a highway, that it's not unreasonable to charge a toll so that all of the users give a couple dollars every time they use it. Would it make sense to say the Jack Weinstein Elementary School is teaching all of these kids arithmetic? So every time a kid in their life remembers that 1 + 1 = 2, they have to give me a penny, right? Am I giving them knowledge that I can own and quantify and monetize the way that I do with a highway, or is that ridiculous? Analogously, is a work of art a great cultural, significantly important work of art more like a highway or more like math? And I would suggest it's more like math. I would suggest that the things that we learn and experience and build off of these great images, off of these great symbols, are collectively owned as opposed to privately owned, and shouldn't and can't be monetized in that way. So now the question is, do you have a moral responsibility to disseminate or present that? So I'll use a slightly different version of the highway example. If you go to England, all of the private land has the requirement that through hikers have to be allowed to walk through it, because all of the land in England, because it's so old, is privately owned. And so if you didn't allow people to walk through it, people wouldn't be allowed to walk through 99% of the country. There was a law for much of England's history that the lords had to let people sleep one night on their land if they were traveling, because there were no airplanes, there were no helicopters. If you had to get from point A to point F, you had to go to B, C, D, and E. And so the law said, you got to give them a day, right? You got to let them, they have to be respectful and all that kind of stuff, but you have to let them sleep there. My sense of all of these images and all of these historical facts are that they are so tremendously important to our self-identity that to deny people access to it is to deny people an access to a certain part of themselves. Maybe it's a tiny little moment. Maybe it's something that they'll never think about with any sustained thought. But nevertheless, it's there. So Let me give you another example. During slavery in the United States, there was this thing called the Slave Bible. Slaves were not allowed to read by law. It was forbidden to teach slaves how to read, but people tried to convert them to Christianity and force them to attend Christian services, et cetera, and they'd read the Bible out loud to them. But the Bibles that they read didn't have the book of Exodus in it. The book of Exodus is the story of the Hebrews, the Israelites, escaping from Egypt, revolting, Moses leading the Israelites in rebellion against Egypt and then going through the desert. And the fear was, if the slaves heard a story of rebellion, they would get the idea that they too could rebel. And so we have to stop them from even having the concept of rebellion, let alone the glorified biblical story of rebellion. George Orwell's 1984 takes this idea of taking language away very, very seriously. This is how important ideas are. This is how important history is. This is how important stories are. So every time we deny people access to a period of history, a tremendous work of art, a vision that someone has of something, we inhibit their ability to imagine and create those similar or analogous things. And that means that by hiding things, we are controlling and limiting other people. And so, yes, I think we have a moral obligation. There are complexities and subtleties and limits and all of this sort of thing.
Here's what made me think of the question, Jack. It has to do with the Titanic, and it's happening right now. A planned auction by the retrieval company has been stopped by the courts of different memorabilia, different items that it has found and wanted to sell. So the courts now are saying maybe we should, or the U.S. government is actually pushing back, saying we shouldn't allow this sale to move forward. Yet family members of survivors who have equivalent items from the Titanic have sold and are allowed to sell these items and have made millions of dollars from them. What's the difference?
Oh, that's such a rich and interesting example. And it recalls a book, I want to say it's the 1960s, but I don't know. I think it's the early 80s a guy named, British guy named John Berger called Ways of Seeing. And in the book, he goes to all these museums and he looks at the little descriptions that are attached to each of the paintings, right? This is a painting by this painter, called this, by this painter, in these dates. And then there's a little narrative description. And at the time, it's gotten better, but at the time, what the descriptions always told was the chain of ownership over the painting. The painter sold it to this person, who then sold it to that person, who inherited from this, that. They gave it to the museum. Why? Because the central message that the museum wanted to communicate was, this is authentic, it's the real thing, and we can prove that we own it. And so in that context, the piece of art becomes a piece of investment and an object completely separate from its more abstract value. It's just a monetary thing. Over time, Berger's book was tremendously influential, and narrative descriptions are now much more focused on the art. This debate is about the same thing. Is the question of the Titanic about the chain of ownership that allows for us to claim authenticity? My great aunt was on the boat. She had this in her pocket. She gave it to me. She gave it to my mom. My mom gave it to me, blah, blah, blah. And therefore it's mine. And therefore it has never been in the public domain. Or is it about the importance of something separate from its investment, separate from its material value? And I think what the court would probably end up saying, and a legal question is not the same thing as a moral question, but would end up saying something like, the Titanic is in international waters. It's been there in the public domain for a century. at a certain point, it stops being some specific person's object and becomes owned by the collective. And the mere act of getting it and pulling it in is not enough to make it property. Just like if I cut down a 200-year-old sequoia tree, the fact that I cut it down doesn't make it mine. It's a long history of debate about what property is and all that sort of stuff, but we don't have to get into that. So the central philosophical question here is, first, can you own everything? And second, is the act of continual ownership the prerequisite for having the right to decide what happens? Because ultimately, what property is the right to make any decision about that thing you want, right? I own the Mona Lisa. I'm allowed to burn it if it's my private property. I think burning the Mona Lisa would be a great, I use this phrase a little nervously, but a crime against humanity in some sense, right? Is the Titanic the same sort of thing? So what we see here is the legal structures are going to try to make a moral argument about this political thing we call property, and then ask whether this political thing that we own property is powerful enough to override this moral obligation we have to collective experience. And that's a hard position to be in, but rests on this fundamental principle that some things are communally owned, or rather, even if we want to say that some things are privately owned, some things still ought to be communally experienced.
Jack, as we kind of wrap up our discussion, if you could give any museum or the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library one philosophical test for its first decade, how would we know, how should we know whether that institution has become a true public institution rather than just an impressive destination?
You ask such the hard questions to conclude. I think there are different rules for art museums than for history museums. For history museum, I would ask the following. Does the museum succeed in explaining why its critics disagree with it? That's the test I would give for a history museum. In other words, the Roosevelt Library is going to make a case that Roosevelt was a great person and did great things, and they may talk about controversies and all that kind of stuff, but it's glorifying a person who played a tremendous role in our history. It's not enough to say the museum is successful if people walk out of the museum believing what the museum says, because that's not education, that's propaganda. Instead, a history museum has to be able to show that by being in the museum, you can understand the controversies that the museum resolved in certain ways, and you can understand all the sides of it so that you can understand and be sympathetic to the decisions that the museum made, but you have enough information to disagree with the museum in. So you have enough information to disagree with the decisions that the museum made. That's what I would say for history museum. For art museums, I would say, has the museum succeeded in making people understand why the things that they see are valuable in and of themselves and valuable culturally? So looking at the Mona Lisa, we have to understand why the Mona Lisa is important contextually in the history of art, but we also just have to be able to look at the Mona Lisa and experience it as beautiful and experience it in and of itself, because all objects of art are both products, are both a process and a product, and sometimes just the experience of the art itself is valuable in and of itself, which is why horribly ugly or evil things can be objects of art, because sometimes we look at a painting not to see beauty, but to see ugliness. Or sometimes we look at a painting to experience fear or confusion or shock. For an art museum, do we understand why this is important in the history of art, but can we also appreciate it as an experience in and of itself, isolated in a conversation, an exclusive, intimate conversation between me, the viewer, and the object that I'm viewing?
Beauty of all of this, Jack, in my eyes, is we all get to go to the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library, look and decide for ourselves what it means. Jack, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for asking the hard questions. And now I really want to go to the library.
I can't wait to see it. I'm very much looking forward to it. It opens this Saturday in Medora. Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein and I visit about current issues in a segment we call Philosophical Currents, about once a month. Jack, continue having a great summer, and we'll look forward to our next conversation.
It's a pleasure to be here, and seeing you every month is one of the best parts of my calendar. A body like Arnold with a Denzel face. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep. And when he comes home, he's relaxed with pep. He always gotta get...
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Hidden Brain. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Jill Freitas. Long before the bald eagle was an American icon, the bird was important to indigenous nations. But eagle populations have suffered in recent years. That's why the Iowa Tribe of Oklahoma's Gray Snow Eagle House has rehabbed hundreds of raptors over the last 20 years. KOSU Sarah Lisi has more on tribe's wildlife conservation efforts.
Social bald eagles nosedive across the large enclosure at the Gray Snow Eagle House, while others perched up high watch. Nearby facility director Megan Judkins looks into the private pens of golden eagles, hawks, and a vulture. While rattling off their names and stories, she stops by a bald eagle who's still maturing.
So this is Cody. He's our young bald eagle in training, so they don't get their full white head and tail until they're five.
Judkins, a Choctaw Nation citizen, says the birds here are from across the country and have been injured in some way. Lead toxicity, electrocutions, car collisions. These raptors can't be released into the wild, but others are on track to being reintroduced.
So we're not able to display our rehab birds because we don't want them getting used to people.
The Gray Snow Eagle House is owned and operated by the Iowa Tribe of Oklahoma and was among the first in the nation. It houses a gift shop, an auditorium, bird enclosures, and an ICU room. Iowa Council member Abraham Lincoln, no relation to the former president, says the work holds a deeper meaning.
The bald eagle is on everything from dollar bills and coins to t-shirts to flags. Now, when you talk about in indigenous ways, especially the Iowa people, across Indian country, it's all relatively the same. For us, it's our connection to God.
Though revered, eagles nearly reached extinction about 40 years ago due to the prevalent use of DDT, a pesticide used to ward off disease-ridden mosquitoes. The decline in eagle health also caused a problem across Indian country, the scarcity of eagle feathers.
When you're given an eagle feather, it's the highest honor. As for individuals, you know, they may use them in different things. So I don't use feathers for regalia reasons. I use mine for cedar ceremonies.
Eventually, the bald eagle gained federal protection. Conservationists reintroduced the bird, starting in Oklahoma, and populations bounced back. Federal law still bans killing and capturing eagles, but citizens of federally recognized tribal nations can legally get feathers and other parts of the bird through the National Eagle Repository. Wait times range from a couple of months to 6 years. the Gray Snow Eagle House has a religious use permit to collect and share feathers with other tribal citizens. In fact, it's a part of a current effort called Operation Feather Give.
And so we're working to give 25 bald eagle feathers to every tribe in Oklahoma as a way to promote connectivity.
It's a big commitment. Raptors only shed their feathers once a year.
And so with that, we've had over 20 tribes come out to our facility now and be able to see what we're doing.
Along with 20 tribal leaders, busloads of students also visit the aviary. In total, the Eagle House sees about 1,500 visitors every year. Engaging the public through awareness efforts is part of the ongoing conservation work. Lincoln has seen the benefits.
We've done enough conservation awareness to educate that local farmer who shot an eagle the last 10 years. You know, maybe it's the hunter that came through that switched to non-lead ammunition to hunt deer or hunt pigs.
It's not a moneymaker, but that's not the point. Judkin says tribally led education and research are crucial to eagle conservation.
The number of eagles that we've brought in for rehabilitation purposes has increased over 50% in the last 5 years. Again, those populations of bald eagles in Oklahoma is going up, so we anticipate that our numbers are also going to go up with that.
While these numbers rise, the Gray Snow Eagle House is working to care for the relatives who've given so much to them. For KOSU, I'm Sarah Lisi.
This story was co-reported with KOSU's Anna Pope. Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Jill Freitas for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 29th. The Fargo newspaper headlines this week in 1957 concentrated on the devastating tornado that had leveled a large swath of the city only days before. An effort called Operation Cleanup was making progress with the damage caused by the twister that drilled through neighborhoods, especially the Golden Ridge area of North Fargo. On this date, the workers were hammered with rain during the daylight hours, but the dampness of the downpour did not deter the quest to aid their neighbors. It was a gargantuan task for the scores of overworked cleanup crews. The Red Cross announced the need of at least $250,000 for the victims of the deadly storm. Citizens of nearly every age were helping, and they came from all around. Mayville High School band members unanimously voted to cancel their long-awaited and expensive first trip to Calgary, Canada. Instead, they sent their travel money and proceeds from two talent shows to help Fargo. A united fund for Fargo was established. It would partner with other groups through the Fargo Community Chest. The chairman of the Fargo Red Cross Disaster Appeals Committee named 23 locals to a disaster appeals unit. He announced, "Those of us who escaped the terrible disaster which struck Fargo and who are able to contribute to this cause should be, and I'm sure they are, thankful for an opportunity to do so." The 1957 Fargo tornado, despite being in an area not familiar to many Americans, was said to be the best documented tornado in history. Researcher Ferguson Hall of the U.S. Weather Bureau said, "We still don't know what triggers a tornado." He added that researchers study available pictures and reports of the storms, and the well-documented Fargo Forum reporting, especially the stunning pictures, had created an invaluable record. That entire treasure trove of photos was made available to the researchers. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Death tolls in Venezuela are rising after two powerful earthquakes that struck back-to-back, toppling high-rises and causing widespread chaos. Emergency workers from several countries, including the U.S., are aiding in the search for survivors.
That's their most immediate need right now, is search and rescue efforts.
That story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's it for this Monday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, NPR's Steve Inskeep visited North Dakota last week and had a wide-ranging conversation with Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library CEO Robbie Loff. We'll have that conversation for you tomorrow, and we look forward to your joining us again.